For example, what we see is when we feed the vagus nerve, for example, specific metabolites that are created by the bacteria of the microbiota, you change parameters in the brain. So for this specific experiment, we used a very young brain and we looked at development. We looked at developmental parameters that are related to learning. So for example, when babies are born, they learn many things. They learn to recognize a mother's face, for example, or they learn how to roll or many other tasks that they learn as they go. And we can measure learning actually in the brains that we have.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your host from the ISAP Board of Directors, Dr. Gabrielle Vinderola.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of this series of podcasts, Science, Microbes and Health. My name is Gabrielle Vinderola and I will be your host this time. The topic that we will be addressing today is the microbiota gut-brain axis on a microfluidic chip to gain insights into neurodegenerative diseases. Our expert today will be Professor Kerenza Brersen. Kerenza, she obtained a PhD in food chemistry in Wageningen University in 2005. Then she followed two postdoctoral positions, and then she joined the University of Twente as assistant professor to further investigate neurodegenerative disorders, making use of neuronal cell type. That is the topic that she will be telling us today. Then Kerenza moved into the field of gut-brain communication, studying the fundamental of signaling pathway, driving the intricate interaction between the intestinal microbiome, the gut, and the brain. For this, she's making use of the differentiation potential of stem cells to create mini version of the organelles involved, culture onto microfluidic devices. Kerenza, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you give us an overview of you study neurodegenerative diseases and now you are developing a model to start? What can you tell that about?
Yeah, so during my first postdoc, I started studying neurodegenerative disorders, and this was specifically targeting Parkinson's disease at that time. And yeah, while we were at it, we were first looking at neurons in isolation. But then actually the realization sort of kicked in that many cells act together to create an outcome that's not very beneficial called Parkinson's disease. And when I moved to the Free University of Brussels, we continued this work, but then converted our work into Alzheimer's disease and looked at more complex models, I would say, involving more organs. And actually, over time, we realized more and more that organs interact quite intensively and together dictate the outcome. And in this case, we're interested in organs that are very distant from the brain. And yeah, I don't know how familiar you are with the Braak staging, which is basically the characterization of postmortem material to characterize where actually specific pathologies stem from. And back then, it was already recognized that, for example, in Parkinson's disease, that lots of the sedimentations that are very typical for Parkinson's disease are also found in the intestine, as well as in the vagus nerve. And later on, people started recognizing that Parkinson's disease comes with severe dysbiosis of the gut microbiota, as well as lots of problems with the gastrointestinal tract already decades before onset of the more traditional symptoms, I would say, that are associated with Parkinson's disease. So, and that actually triggered us to hypothesize that many of these diseases may actually originate or at least be associated with dysfunction and changes in functionality of, for example, the microbiota. And to study that, it's really complex. We first thought of, when you think about clinical studies, they're great. You know, they're fantastic, of course, because they're very informative. They tell us a lot about epidemiological findings, about clinical observations, and they're, of course, super valuable there. Then people started using animal models, and they brought us a lot, right? Let's not be mistaken there. They're very valuable because they have very high order, I would say, physiological complexity. But we felt both are very much black box approaches. So you can't really look at specific signaling events. You can't easily modulate them. Animals are not humans. So the translation potential is also, well, poor at best. And then we felt, well, maybe we could make use of this new field of organoid chip technology to look at how the gut and the brain communicate. So at first, we're interested in the physiological interaction. And then we started looking at more the pathology. And that's more the result of many collaborations that we have at this stage.
So you mentioned human studies, mouse studies, but then you decide to make like your own small brain at the lab. Can you tell us a little bit more? How do you get a small piece of brain from a cell? That's a very fascinating technique.
Yeah. We're every single day, we're very pleased with what's happening and what you can make. It's still surprising me on a daily basis, to be honest. But what you actually do is we make use of stem cells, and stem cells are cells that have not reached a differentiation state, right? Think of a neural or a skin cell. They are differentiated cell types. Stem cells can actually, what we call, differentiate or change into these definite types of cells. And we know how to do that. We know how to drive them towards these from, that's truly inspired by all we know about embryonic developmental biology. So we know that specific factors, for example, or exposure to specific factors drives them to make a neuron, or drives them to make a skin cell or a gut or a liver or a cardiac tissue, what else have you. So basically, by exposing these stem cells to these growth factors or specific factors in a very timely manner, we can make cells that represent the brain. They sort of cluster together, and not spontaneously, I would say, but they are driven towards making mini brains and mini hearts and mini guts and mini livers and mini kidneys and many of these tissues. Yeah.
I assume you get stem cells from healthy people, right?
Yeah. At this moment we do. Yeah, we can get them from healthy people. Originally get them from bone marrow, for example, but now we can get them from blood or even from urine. And yeah, being able to say that you created a brain from urine, that's pretty amazing, actually. Yeah, you can get them from healthy people, but you can also get them from people who carry a specific genetic mutation, for example. Right. So, but at this moment we use them from healthy people. But
and how long does it take to build like a mini brain, and how long can the brain be useful for you in the lab? How long can you keep it alive, let's say?
Those are two great questions, right? That really defines what we can do with it. Yeah, to create it, it's usually a matter of weeks, sometimes a month. We can keep them alive. Until now, we've shown living brain organoids, as we call them, these mini brains, for 100 days and probably even longer. That experiment was cut short by something called the pandemic, but we managed until then to keep them alive and functional, actually, for 100 days, which is good in a way. But still, if you think about it, if you want to study neurodegenerative disorders, of course, which take about 60 years to develop, that's still a short while, right? But
So are you able to, when you produce this, let's say, mini brain for people to understand, that's a healthy brain, or can you even differentiate to resemble a brain with a specific disease? Can you produce the disease also in the model?
Yeah, so there's various ways. Yes, the answer is yes. There's various ways to do that. We can either induce a mutation with gene editing. So for many diseases, we know specific genes that are related to these pathologies, and we can mutate them to create a pathology, or we can expose them to specific factors, for example, that we know induces a pathology, or protein deposits, for example, that are related to it. So yeah, you can create a diseased brain, if you like, in many different ways. And depending on the question that you have, you use a specific approach. Correct.
And the piece of brain you produce resembles a specific part of the brain, or is like a general thing? How can you say this resembles
Yeah, the brain is super complex. You're completely right. So at this stage, we can create, for example, the hippocampus very well, which is the region of the brain that is affected in Alzheimer's disease, for example. And we know that we make this specific region of the brain because the hippocampus expresses specific proteins and we can measure those, right? We call them biomarkers and we use those to say, okay, look, this protein is specifically expressed by the hippocampus and we identify specifically that protein in this region of the brain that we create. But we can, yeah, cortical or brainstem or, yeah, there's various regions that we can mimic depending, again, on the question that we have. Yeah.
And that piece of brain will have different cell populations. Can you differentiate astrocytes, glials, a little bit of everything you will have?
Yeah, well, so normally if you, when you start from a stem cell and you differentiate into neurons, you quite naturally at some stage also have astrocytes. We basically see those occur spontaneously. Microglia do not, and that's because they are created at a different stage of embryonic development. So what we do then is, if we have questions that involve microglia, what we do is we make a separate differentiation of stem cells. We expose those stem cells to a different set of markers or effectors, I mean, and then they create microglia. And when you co-incubate them, so basically you have a test tube and you co-incubate the brain organoids you have with those microglia, they sort of spontaneously infiltrate and they are actually doing their job, right? They are being immunosurveillant, for example, or they can be triggered to become inflammatory, etc. So yeah, partly spontaneously, partly induced.
Right. So now it's clear that you are able to produce a piece of brain, a model that is working. And let's leave it aside for a moment and tell us a little bit more for the people that is not really aware how this gut and brain connect. How do they, because we think they are, maybe they are organs that are very far from the other, but we know that they communicate. How is this communication?
Yeah, that was absolutely the triggering thought that triggered me very much indeed. It was like they are 1 meter apart from each other. How on earth do they communicate so intensively? Yeah, the clinical evidence is there. It's very rock solid, I would say. So there's various ways in which they can communicate, and they can communicate by something called the vagus nerve. Mm-hmm. So the vagus nerve is a very extensive nerve bundle that innervates both the gut and the brain, and at the site of the brain stem, actually. And it actually innervates other peripheral organs as well, right? So it's not only the gut, but it innervates, for example, the cardiac tissue as well. So that's one major route. And we know this is happening because, for example, if you have a mouse model and you ablate the vagus nerve, you see very big differences in, for example, microbiota population. So we know this plays a role. But another route, quite naturally, is via the blood. Mm. So when you have the intestine and you ingest a specific type of food, for example, it's first digested and then individual molecules are released into the bloodstream and those get into the circulation. And at some stage, they may actually cross the blood-brain barrier and enter the brain from there. Right. So that's another route. And then, of course, the immune system is a very great contributor. So I would say there's multiple routes, and collectively they define the outcome, how the brain responds to any external factor, for example.
And when we see these neurodegenerative diseases, they are always associated with the dysbiosis. Any disease. Do you think, what is the cause and the consequence? What changes first? Is the dysbiosis that will induce the disease? Vice versa, both things happen at the same time. What do your sense?
Yeah, well, that's the $1 million question at this stage. I have absolutely no clue. I guess the fact that, for example, Parkinson's disease coincides with gastrointestinal issues or decades before the onset of symptoms that are related to the brain could indicate that dysbiosis is actually something that occurs first, but we're by no means sure. right? There could be many things. Yeah, there could be many factors changing in the brain that we're not really aware of or that give no symptoms, for example. So to be honest, I have absolutely no idea. And that's exactly what we would like to study in my lab, is to start to understand much better, okay, so what actually is the cause? What is the effect? How are they interrelated? How can they be modulated? That would be even more exciting, right? If we can use this route to maybe identify modulating factors that identify and change pathogenesis.
And now let's go back a little bit to your model. You have your model well developed and characterized. And how do you think, or if you're already doing it, how are you contacting this model with the gut microbes? How do you do this communication that happens in our body?
Yeah, that's critical for the question that we have. So what we use for this is a microfluidic device. And this is actually a mini incubator, if you like. So you incubate, so you have like all these mini chambers and mini channels, and they connect with each other. And in one of these mini incubators, you culture your brain. In one of the other ones, you culture your gut. And then you have like this long channel in which you culture, for example, your vagus neurons. And they are able to connect via pores. They are able to connect both. And there's many advantages to doing this because we know, for example, that we can, the microenvironmental conditions that make a brain or a gut thrive are very different. So that's good. Now, in this intestinal compartment, we can culture as well. We can make co-culture with microbiota, for example, derived from the fetus of a healthy or a person with a specific pathology. So that actually you can induce as well. And then you can, for example, generate changes in the brain compartment using genetic modification, for example, and look at, okay, what's the impact on the intestinal microbiota composition? And vice versa, you can change the microbiota composition by depleting, for example, specific strains or enriching others, or by depleting it altogether by using, for example, broad-spectrum antibiotic or purified strains, and then look at the effects in the brain. So that's actually how you can do it. And you can make changes on the way as well to look at that, a little bit biomarker.
So in these chips, you have like, let's say like three chambers. In one, you have your brain, then you have your vagal nerve, and then you have the gut, the microbiota in a very small piece of material.
Yeah, there are USB-sized, stick-sized dimension. You can think about that. Yeah.
And do you have any data that you can share with us, something that you already saw in this communication?
For example, what we see is when we feed the vagus nerve, for example, specific metabolites that are created by the bacteria of the microbiota, you change parameters in the brain. So for this specific experiments, we use the very young brain. And we looked at development. And we looked at developmental parameters that are related to learning. So, for example, when babies are born, they learn many things. They learn to recognize their mother's face, for example, or they learn how to roll, or many other tasks that they learn as they go. And we can measure learning, actually, in the brains that we have. We can ask them, of course, how do you learn, or how do you sleep, or do you feel well? You can't ask a mini brain that. But there's many biochemical markers that you can measure that are directly related to these kind of cognitive outcomes. And we've seen that if we expose the system to short-chain fatty acids, which is specific metabolites generated by bacteria, that this actually helps develop the brain in a way that is indicating better learning, for example, right? So this actually already shows that the microbiota and the metabolites that they produce are instrumental to learning, for example. I don't want to say that they wouldn't do that in the absence, but we do see clear differences in an experiment that we did in our setup and our conditions. We can see differences actually when we expose our brains to these types of metabolites that are related to brain function.
And now in the when you take a look in the literature, you see like it's quite popular the use of butyric acid, like mm-hmm. isolate metabolites. But I always have the idea because they are produced three at the same time: propionate, acetate, and how do you think they are? How independent did you take a look how independent they act, or if they should be like a group produced three that all of them at the same time?
Yeah, no, we haven't looked at that yet. I can sort of second guess that they will be independent. First of all, plain intuition, why would you generate three? But also, I know that butyric acid, for example, is metabolized differently. I think there's probably differences, let's say like that. We haven't measured that yet. What we have done until now is to use combinations of the three together. The specific three short chain fatty acids, actually. But yeah, it would definitely be of interest to look at one specifically and see what difference it would make. Something else we would be interested in is look at, for example, when you have bacteria and you culture them, they generate so much more, right, than only these short chain fatty acids.
Absolutely.
They actually expose that and identify specific molecules that are relevant there, specific metabolites, specific intermediates that are critical. I guess if you look at like all the amino acids, for example, or specific precursors for neurotransmitters. So there's many signaling molecules that could be relevant here that would be of interest. But yeah, that's how we do it now.
And I think this model opens like a very interesting field to develop of new drugs in the pharmacy field, because it's like I don't know if it's one-to-one, but you put one drug and you can sense what it have. Do you have any experience in assessing other things than metabolite for microbes, or is in the future?
Yeah, that's all in the future, indeed. That is definitely a potential route we could go. I think, indeed, that there's many ways of identifying, first of all, factors that could be interesting to target by drugs. Also, you can screen. I wouldn't say it's high throughput, right? But I would say maybe medium throughput at this stage, right? We're looking at higher throughput methodologies at this stage. But at this stage, it's very fiddly, right? Everyone takes it.
It's a lot of time, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But it's definitely something that the organelle tip field in general is very interested in looking at. Okay, can we use these models to screen, to identify specific doses of molecules, to reuse medication that has been used before, like retargeting, and to look at off target. So and actually to do that, you often see more complex models even that include, for example, livers, because livers are, of course, very good at metabolizing drugs. And sometimes it's a great thing that could help. Sometimes it's actually negative,
And do you think that in the future you can combine organoids from different parts of the brain, like to produce some more sophisticated models? Or they can they these organoids dialogue, communicate between them? Or if...
So you mean to create an assembled brain that has many of the different regions together? That's what that's actually been done already. They're called assembloids. Assembloids. So people create indeed specific distinct regions, and then they fuse them. It sounds ridiculously simple. It's of course not, but it's basically coming down to that. And what then happens is that you actually see neurons extend across to other regions as well, and actually forming quite extensive circuitry. And that's very interesting because, for example, in the case of Parkinson's disease, but also for other neurodegenerative disorders, you can clearly see a transmission of a pathology across the brain to first target a specific brain region and then to extend to other brain regions. And we still don't know how that exactly works, right? And these could be very exciting models to look at that, to really look at, okay, if you first had this first part of the brain affected, and then how does the disease actually transmit?
Express, exactly. And you mentioned some biomarkers of cognition and Alzheimer's or Parkinson, if I'm not wrong. Do you have any, or are you studying other biomarkers of depression, anxiety, other conditions in the brain?
Yeah, we look at multiple sclerosis, for example, at this moment. So that's a pathology that we studied together with a group in Milan. And they're very interested because, short-chain fatty acids are now hypothesized to modulate the pathogenic progression of multiple sclerosis. So we're testing that together with them. But also for other types of amyloidosis, so basically protein deposition diseases, as well as autism spectrum disorders. And also, very simple, other systems like what does sleep deprivation do? For example, disturbed sleep pattern or disturbed circadian rhythm altogether.
Can you mimic sleep deprivation in this model?
Yeah, you can actually by changing serotonin levels, for example.
Oh, wait, so, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, circadian rhythm, I think that's, the concept of that is, it's very complex, right? So I don't know, of course, but you can mimic specific aspects. So let's say like that, specific aspects that are of interest there by changing and modulating specific levels of neurotransmitters related to that.
You know, when we start thinking in this episode, it was not easy to find groups that are working in this topic. Is this really new or is it like a small society? How do you see this area being addressed in different parts of the world? Do you have like a network of people working in this?
There's a few, not generally making use of stem cell technology. So sometimes of immortalized cell lines, for example. Some make use of stacked chambers, for example. There's a few of those, maybe two or three groups that do that. Yeah, but not many. I think many are still mostly interested in maybe individual or isolated tissues, right? And then I can see why. I mean, there's so many questions to address, even in isolated tissue types. So that makes total sense. But we just like things that are, I guess, difficult. This is really typically something that's very complex. Sometimes we think, what are we doing actually? What do we start with?
I see. We are slowly coming to the end of this episode, but let me ask you, how do you see your field, your science in the next 5-10 years? Where do you think you will be in this period of time?
What we really want to do is to exactly understand which molecules, which signaling events play a role in communication between the gut and the brain, and how external factors play a role. For example, how food affects the composition of the microbiota such that you can mess around with your own brain, right? I mean, that would be amazing if people understand better, okay, if I use this type of dietary intervention, my brain lasts longer or my memories are better, or that's bold statements, right? But you have to start somewhere. But my group would really like to understand the basic physiology of this interaction such that we understand better, okay, how can we target? How can we make changes? How is this affected? And indeed, answer these cause response type of questions, that would be great.
And if people are interested in your work, where can they find more? Maybe web page and Instagram and Twitter, how they communicate?
Yeah, we have we just recently started an Instagram account. But the best way is actually to look at our website, which is Applied Stem Cell Technologies.
We will put it in the book.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to let us know before we say goodbye?
It's always good to keep the questions very challenging, right? And to challenge ourselves to address the more complex questions and to not shy away from new technologies altogether. I think that's the main thing.
Querenza, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating topic and you gave us very, very helpful insights. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much, Gabriel.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.